Thank you all for braving the storm and coming out on a wet morning. It seems appropriate to start with a relevant Zen story about the true self. Of Buddha nature. So this is case 46 in the Blue Cliff Record. Jing Jing's Sound of Raindrops. Jing Jing asked the monk, "What sound is that outside the gate?" Gates in Buddhist language often refer to the sense gates through which the world comes to us, through these gates called the six gates. So what is that sound outside the gate? And the monk said, "It's the sound of raindrops." And Jing said, "Sentient beings are inverted. They lose themselves and follow after things." Sentient beings are inverted. They lose the true self and follow after things. The monk said, "What about you, teacher?" And Jing said, "I almost don't lose myself." The monk said, "What's the meaning of 'I almost don't lose myself'?" And Jing said, "Though it is relatively easy to become one, to leave oneness must be difficult." It's relatively easy to turn the light around and remember that space in which the sound of the raindrops are happening, our true self. But to see everybody and everything as our true self in the world of differentiation, that's has to be difficult, challenging. It's one way to understand this story. And Hakuin Zenji, commenting on this story, says, "What is it that hears the sound of raindrops? Direct this question to your own self nature." Very nicely, we have some sound of raindrops today, and we have a sound of a voice, and we have the sound of the words of the Parinirvana Sutra. So as we're listening to all these things, we can also see if we can remember at the same time the true self in which all these experiences are arising and ceasing. So, a little review. Maybe we could try it as a kind of quiz. This is the conventionally true self and the ultimately true self. It's nice to compare and contrast and remember the difference between these two. We know the false self, I think, is more clear, that that's like feeling that there's some experience or in the body and mind, or some part of the body and mind that is the experiencer, some entity, some separate, independent, singular self. that we, when we grasp that one, we feel cut off and separate, and we're not content if we identify with this separate false self. But the conventionally true self and the ultimately true self, I think it's nice to play with this a little more, because this sutra is particularly about this ultimately true self. So the conventionally true self, remember, is this just a convenient name for a causal series of body and mind experiences. Is this conventionally true self permanent or impermanent? What'd you say? What?
Impermanent,
yeah. It's totally impermanent. It's all these body and mind experiences only last a moment, if that. Right? It's arising and ceasing, totally impermanent, moment to moment. Now, the ultimately true self, in comparison, remember that now the ultimately true self is the hearing of the raindrops, big open awareness in which everything is happening. It's not so much that a dualistic consciousness that goes out and experiences objects. It's more the non-dual awareness in which everything is arising and ceasing. It's the experiencing of the body and mind experiences as manifestations of itself. So the ultimately true self is, you could say, the experiencing of the conventionally true self as a manifestation of its complete, total selfness.
Process, not object.
And even process, I think if somebody were to say, which self would be the process of experiences, I might say the conventionally true self, this causal series, is also a kind of process. Really, this ultimately true self is like, in a sense, it's unmoving and still, unchanging. Remember, the pure Dharmakaya neither appears nor disappears. That's a little different from a process. So, in that sense, is this ultimately true self, is that one impermanent or permanent?
Permanent.
Permanent, yeah. Ooh, permanent. We might cringe as good Buddhists. So maybe because we think of something being permanent. No entities are permanent. No things are permanent. No objects are permanent. No experiences are permanent. But this big, not even really big, this all-inclusive, all-pervading awareness of true self is, it doesn't change. In this model of Buddha nature, it's not something that changes, not something that comes and goes when the experiences come and go. But it's not something. If it were a thing and it were permanent, that would be a problem. But it's more like the experiencing is totally ungraspable. It's not a thing. But the experiencing, in this case, is unchanging. And unchanging is another way of saying permanent. A little bit more palatable way, if you say permanent or eternal. This translation of the sutra often uses eternal.
How is that distinguished from a process?
Because nothing's happening. It's unchanging. Okay. It's unchanging. This true self. That's what permanent means. You could say the totality of the process itself is unchanging. If we say like that, then that's okay. But the workings of the process are constantly changing. Yes.
Also, perhaps because there is no goal, no outcome, was the a common sense of process is that we're going somewhere.
Ah, yes.
So perhaps that's a distinction.
Yeah, yeah. It's not going anywhere, and in fact, nothing's happening from the perspective of true self. So that's why it's also called emptiness in this sutra and other sutras. Buddha nature is another name for emptiness. So there's a big difference between the conventionally true self and the ultimately true self. First one's impermanent, the second one's permanent or eternal, unchanging. So now this conventionally true self, the causal series, is it conditioned or dependent? I would say those words are almost the same. Or is it unconditioned and independent? The conventionally true self, the causal series of it. It's impermanent, so it's conditioned. Those two go together, right? Yep. It's everything in our body and mind experiences are arising and ceasing, means they're impermanent, and they arise and cease dependent on other factors. Dependent arising is the arising and ceasing of everything moment to moment, dependent on other parts of the causal series and other causal series. So conventional truth is sometimes talked about as dependent arising and ceasing, and it's impermanent. It's conventionally true. So this causal series self is conditioned by past causal series selves and by other causal series selves. It's dependent on them, and it's impermanent. Whereas the ultimately true self, is that one conditioned or dependent? And no. Again, it's kind of a hard one, right? If we say there's no things, there's no entities that are independent or unconditioned, but this is not a thing or an entity. Emptiness is the unconditioned, is the independent in a way. Independent just means doesn't depend on anything else. If this awareness were somehow slightly dependent on something else, and that's why we have to be clear that it's not our usual consciousness, because in the Buddha's system, the fifth skanda of consciousness is another dependent arising and ceasing phenomena, dependent on objects. This true self of awareness is not dependent on objects. There are no objects outside of itself. There's nothing outside of itself. It's all-inclusive. If it's all-inclusive, how could it be dependent on anything else? There's nothing other than it. Buddha nature. So, independent or unconditioned.
And is it aware?
Yeah, so sometimes we can say ultimate truth of emptiness is the unconditioned and unborn. But in this case of Buddha nature, it's a slight twist. It's saying, yes, we're talking about this emptiness, but it's aware. That's what's unique to these third turning of the Dharma wheel teachings of Buddha nature. It's not just an absence or inert space. It's totally ungraspable, and yet it is awareness itself. It's not like it's something that is aware. That would be some conditioned thing. It is awareness itself. It is aware emptiness, or it is empty awareness. And, it's
different from how we use awareness of existence.
Yeah, I like to use the word consciousness for when we're talking about being aware of something. That's where there's a sense of a subject and an object. I'm aware of a visual color or a sound of a raindrop. That is consciousness. Vijnana in Sanskrit means divided knowing. It's divided between a subject and an object. We could say dualistic knowing is consciousness. That's how we usually translate vijnana. And that's not this Buddha nature. But the Buddha nature is sometimes spoken of as jnana, or undivided knowing, non-dual knowing, non-dual awareness. Timeless, spaceless, unchanging, unconditioned awareness. And, you know, this is, I think, it's somewhat questionable teaching in the, it's a debatable teaching in the Buddha's system. Some people feel like, you can't, if you start saying that emptiness is aware, or there is an aware emptiness that's unconditioned, how can you not say that it's some sort of graspable thing? Some people feel like, let's just stay with emptiness. That's safer. Let's leave out this awareness part. So that's the difference between the second turning of the wheel and the third turning of the wheel.
It seems like it's like a coin, because our mind can't grasp it. My mind can't grasp it. So thought is trying to make sense, but it's conceptualizing.
Yeah.
And it's not a logical thing. So it has to go outside of its capacity, and that's like the flash.
It's not a logical thing. We can't grasp it. It's ungraspable by its very nature. And yet, the proposition is that it is our true self, and it's always present. If it's eternal, of course, it's always present. It's not going to arise sometime in the future, or it would be conditioned. So, and yet we can, this sutra anyway says that Buddhas can see their Buddha nature. So we don't see it as something or some experience. It's not even an experience. It's the source of experience. It's the experiencing of experience. So in the Zen tradition, they try to make this much more simple than these sutras that say, wow, that's just inconceivable. The Zen tradition, like Hakuin, says things like, what is it that hears the sound of the raindrops? Very simple, right? What is it that's hearing this? Well, it's me. Well, who's me? Is it the body and mind that's hearing? Well, conventionally we could say that, but what is it that's aware of the body and mind? We keep stepping back further and further until there is some awareness that it seems to be always here, and unchanging as the experiences change. And we can keep exploring that without getting a hold of it and without logically trying to prove it or something. Here it is. So, we've distinguishing the conventionally true self and the ultimately true self. One's impermanent, one's permanent or eternal. In Sanskrit, that's anicca and nitya. The ahs makes things negative. So the sutra says this Buddha nature is nitya, continuous, permanent, unchanging. And one is dependent or conditioned, and one is unconditioned, independent. Now regarding the causal series, the conventionally true self, is it located in a particular place and a particular time? The convention. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This, remember, there's 7 billion human conventional cells. Each one has a different location in time and space. This causal series I call Kokyo is currently, you could say the causal series, conventionally speaking, is located on this seat, right? And at this particular time. You could see the causal series also extends back into the past, but it's always as the body and mind experiences, it's always happening right here in a particular place and right now in a particular time for each of us. It's located. It's it's specific. Whereas the ultimately true self, is this one located in particular time and space? No, it's not, right? These help to meditate on, to contemplate what kind of thing we're talking about here. It's unchanging. It means it's ever present. It's all pervading. Or it's unlocated. Means it's all pervading. It's not located in a particular time and space. All pervading and eternal means it's everywhere and always. Or another way to say it, I think is maybe a little more accurate to say, it's not that it extends through time and it extends through space. Really, it's more like it is unchanging, and what we call space and time are arising within it. That's a little different, right? It's quite radical theory, right? It's not so much that it is pervading what we call time and it's pervading what we call space. It's inconceivable, and what we call space and time are actually kind of human constructions that are arising from consciousness within, timeless, spaceless, true self, Buddha nature. Yes. Yeah.
I kind of like that a little bit. Is it could help us to be more kind of attentive to its all pervasiveness everywhere, all the time.
Yeah. There's like if we're rummaging through that pile of junk in the back of our closet and we think that that's not our true self, then, we can't escape it. Everywhere we go, we find it. And Dungshan's Jiumir Samadhi says, it's not so much that you, the person, are it. It actually, in truth, is you. So it's not so much that everything is it, but it is everything. And yeah, there's no exceptions, so it's nice to contemplate how whatever's happening, you could say, is an expression or a manifestation of this Buddha nature. Even painful experiences, there's no exceptions. There's nothing outside of it, right? So that's nice to remember that. But speaking of painful experiences, to continue that a little bit in comparing the two selves, the conventionally true self of this causal series of experiences, is that one sometimes painful? Yeah, it is, right? You could say, we're calling it experiences. Many experiences are painful, unsatisfying. Whereas the ultimately true self, is that true self sometimes painful? No, it's actually not, right? As I just said, it can manifest as painful experiences. It's free to do that, and it does do that. But it itself is untainted. If it were sometimes painful and sometimes pleasant, that would be changing. It's not something that changes. It's like neutral, but it allows all painful and pleasant experiences. Practically speaking, you could say it is the experiencing of a painful experience. So there really is a painful experience happening, but the experiencing of the painful experience is not painful. Can you see that distinction? It's quite subtle. But this means that if we can kind of again, it's like this shift of perspective. If we can remember this true self that's never suffering, right at the same time as I'm suffering, then we have a different perspective on our suffering. It's like the pure knowing of suffering is just neutral. And therefore, it's said to be, the awareness itself is always content. It can be aware of discontent, but again, aware of discontent as a manifestation of itself, but it itself is never discontent. That's why the sutra says it's called sukha, I think is the word, bliss. They sometimes translate it as bliss or happiness or contentment, as opposed to dukkha. The convention of the true self is, the Buddha even says, it's like always slightly dissatisfied. But this is all-pervading dukkha for the conventional self. Whereas for the true self, it's always inherently and beginninglessly and endlessly content. And it is our true nature is always content. Even when our conventional self is having a hard time. So, can you follow us so far? I think this is nice to make these distinctions, and you can see the import of these points, especially the point about this contentment versus discontentment. I mean, this is where we all want to be happy, and this is a kind of a non-dual radical way of, without changing the conditions, we can start to recognize the already content one, and as our true self, and let our identity shift more into that one, without rejecting the conventional self, or bypassing the conventional self. What's that? Yeah, the suffering that we call experiences of suffering are still happening as long as we're, as long as there is a causal series of body and mind experiences, there will be discontent. So in this life, in this human life, with its limited lifespan, we can live with this, in this body and mind. But it's part of this parinirvana issue too, though, even in the early teachings, right? There's some implication of the Buddha's like, yeah, there's still this painful body thing going on here, and it's fine, it's okay, because it's a manifestation of my true self. But I'm kind of looking forward to this parinirvana thing when we don't have to, live in this painful body anymore. That's even in the early sutras. So there's some compare and contrast. As far as this awareness issue, we could say there is something it is like to be hearing the sound of raindrops. For each of us hearing the sound of raindrops, isn't there something it is like to be hearing the raindrops? We can't quite say what that is, but we don't say it's nothing. There is something it's like to be hearing the raindrops. This is one of those phrases that I think is more from the kind of cognitive science point of view that they're using in sort of Western traditions to talk about the self these days, is the what it is likeness, what it is like to be experiencing something. And I think the one who coined the term actually was looking at a lizard or a bird or some kind of animal and saying, when we look at that animal, we don't know what it's like to be them, but we can kind of assume there's something it is like to be a lizard experiencing the world. Follow that? I find it's a helpful little phrase. There's something it is like, created by the reflexivity of awareness, that awareness is knowing itself. In other words, we're listening to the raindrops, but we know we're experiencing the raindrops. Means there's a self-knowing awareness. It's knowing itself as it's knowing the sound. And that reflexivity of awareness that can know itself is the difference between a so-called sentient being and a sound detector. You can have like a microphone that's a sound detector, but that's not a sentient being. And you could say, we're not just a sound detector, right? We have these ears, but there's something it's like to be hearing the sound. For the microphone, it's not that there's something it's like to be hearing the sound, it's just registering sound. And even a highly, so this is interesting, I think, to these days people are talking about artificial intelligence more and more. And some people are saying, we can create like consciousness, can't we? We're almost at the verge of being able to do that with modern AI technology, right? But I would say this is still the difference between a sentient being is there's a what it is likeness. I don't imagine that artificial intelligence can create that what it is likeness, you know, to be. You can be a highly evolved computer you could have such a thing that could respond to all kinds of different things and seem almost like a human to other humans. They're pretty close to this already, I think, right? But it's not a human because it's just registering events and quickly computing how to respond. It's not like humans are just computers like that. There's what it is like to be a sentient being. So that's a little bit about this awareness quality. It's hard to pinpoint what it exactly is. Yes?
With the progression of the science and what they're experiencing, it seems like the vocabulary that's evolving is a little more refined than the traditional seems to be a little clunky.
Ah, yeah, about the nature of the self and so
yeah.
on. Yeah, sometimes these old sutras are a little tough to know exactly what they're saying. That's why it's nice to have classes like this. We can try to bring out the meaning, the hidden meaning, as sometimes is talked about in this Nirvana Sutra. Yeah, I agree. It's like we're finding more better ways to talk about the ineffable.
Kind of be a slippery slope into metaphysics, though, where we're asking questions that we can't know, and we're speculating, and we're in the mind realm trying to do something the mind realm can't do. It's not knowable.
So I think that my understanding of metaphysics is like we're kind of proposing some workings of reality that we can't actually know, but we're sort of imagining how it might be. Something like that, maybe metaphysics. We're imagining some way. Whereas the nice thing about these Buddha nature teachings is I think we can really try as good scientists to stay with our direct experience. And that's why I like these questions like, is awareness present? Like, yes. And like, are you sure that awareness is present? It's undeniable. There's no metaphysical speculation. There is awareness here. We can all say, even a child on the street who's never heard of the Nirvana Sutra, yes, of course there's awareness. And no one could convince us otherwise. So I think that keeps us out of the realm of metaphysics. And then we can start to examine our own experience very closely and carefully, and staying with our experience without proposing any wild theories. I think we can go quite far. Like we can say, now we're from the point of view of awareness, can we find any edges or boundaries to it? We can look in our own experience instead of saying it's all pervading. If we just say, yeah, Buddha nature is all pervading throughout the universe, it sounds kind of metaphysical theory, right? But if we say, in my own direct experience right now, if I look very carefully, can I find any edges or boundaries of awareness? It's not the kind of thing that has edges or boundaries, if we start to look. It's not a spatial, three-dimensional thing. So we can't really find any boundaries. And if we can't find any boundaries, then can there be things or experiences happening outside of awareness? And we could say, no, it doesn't really make sense. If there's no boundaries, what does outside mean? So this kind of exploration of our own direct experience, I think, is the best. And then when we start to put it into words, it sounds kind of metaphysical to say, like, an independent, permanent reality of unchanging, all-pervading awareness. Whoa, Kokyo, like, that's going, where are you coming up with that? I think we can, in our very ordinary experience, we can start to confirm some of these radical statements. Yes?
This is just slightly tangential, but not really. And it's my burning question, so I beg you to indulge me, everyone. So the idea of direct experience is extremely powerful for me. And I have direct experiences that are quite different from most other people in this Zendo, most likely, I'm guessing. But let's just say that's true, provisionally, for the moment. Buddhism, it seems, sometimes, depending on the teacher and the teaching that's being taught in any given moment, focuses a lot on things that we all agree are absolutely true. It's within everyone's direct experience. And some other teachings, for example, this one, seem to be pointing at things that we can, most of us, probably all of us, can sort of say, yeah, that seems like it must be true, but they don't necessarily have a direct, personal, vibrant, in-the-body experience of it all the time. And so, I guess what I'm just trying to formulate my question here. Something about direct experience, it isn't completely consensual universally. You know, like, I have direct experiences that people who I respect highly think are insane and ludicrous because they don't have them. But I do, and I'm actually not insane and ludicrous.
So for one thing, I would say the way we're using the language so far in this class is anything we call experience, direct or indirect, conceptual or non-conceptual, experience is the realm of the so-called conventionally true self. It's something that's not always the case. It arises and ceases in consciousness, and then it can be very direct and powerful, but it's a temporary experience in a certain time, right? And so, and that's true that you have different experiences, direct and indirect, from everybody else. And we all, that's the nature of the causal series. We all, it's different for each of us. But the experiencing of true self is, again, not an experience that arises in time and space. Maybe we could confirm that, that true self, that experiencing, or the confirmation might seem to strike our consciousness at a particular time and space. So-called enlightenment experience. People talk about that. But the true self is not an enlightenment experience. It's like the experiencing of enlightenment experiences and delusion experiences. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's, and you can see that's the one we all share, but you're also, make a good point that, not everybody is, recognizes or appreciates their true self. That's, even though it's always here, experiencing, we overlook it because I think the reason why we overlook it, most all of us, is because we're so into experiences. We're attending to experiences. They're what's the content of our life. But this experiencing has no content. It is not content. So or it's not interesting. But that's why, as practitioners, we can start to examine the nature of experiencing. And so I think it's good. So I think this is good to say, if it feels like, I got it, I have a little enlightenment, or a big enlightenment experience about this true self. Yeah, that's great. It's nice to confirm this with our ordinary, or our consciousness, our dualistic consciousness, as a particular event in time and space. But really, we want to appreciate this always all-pervading kind of background of awareness itself that's not an experience. And I think that's in Dogen Zen, Soto Zen, where we emphasize more this kind of ordinary, all-pervading, always the case experiencing, and de-emphasize the particular time and space enlightenment experience that's more emphasized in Rinzai Zen. So,
I think my teachers at San Francisco Zen Center for 20 years did not emphasize the big picture Buddha nature aspect of things. They emphasized the ordinary causal series experiences of everyday life.
Well, they're much easier to talk about.
Yes, they are.
and that's the realm also of, like, it's important. This is the realm of our ordinary life. The bodhisattva precepts, we could say. That's all in the realm of the conventionally true self. And we try to practice beneficial action and so on. So there's lots of teachings. Maybe most of the Buddha's teachings even are about the conventionally true self. But there's also these teachings about the ultimately true, like this sutra. This sutra does both also. But because it's harder to understand this ultimately true when we might just miss it. So that's why we talk about it today. Remember also that this true self is not an agent or a doer. In Sanskrit, there's this word kartri that means like an agent or a doer. And it's not an experiencer in Sanskrit. Boktri. So we can, I think this is good to keep in mind that if we start thinking or feeling as if this, our true self is some kind of experiencer, it's very similar to experiencing. It starts to make it into an entity that arises and ceases or something like that. So it seems like, as I look into how these pieces all fit together, that all these teachings about not self in Buddhism, even when they sometimes talk about kind of in later Indian tradition, they even start to talk about these other schools of Buddhism that propose a true Atman, and even like even some of them go so far as like an all-pervading true self as an Atman, and the Buddhist texts try to refute that. But they always have, as far as I understand it today, they're always implying that that philosophical view of some school says that the all-pervading Atman is some kind of experiencer or some kind of agent, that self actually kind of experiences objective experiences somehow as separate from itself. Instead of saying that experiences are manifestations or expressions or the display of awareness arising within awareness, as awareness, made of awareness. That really non-dual view, they're never refuting that. But it seems like these different traditions that start to get a hint about this true self, they put in this thing, which is so natural for us to do, of it's some kind of experiencer. And the Buddhist teachers are always saying, if you say it's an experiencer, then it's graspable, and therefore it is then a seed for suffering. Anything that's graspable will is the condition for suffering. So that's another point. The this Buddha, so talking about the unchanging aspect, here's another reflection I think that's helpful. This Buddha nature model of one unchanging awareness can be applied to this moment where many experiences are happening simultaneously. In other words, we could say in the Buddha nature model, there's one awareness that's experiencing colors and sounds and feelings and thoughts simultaneously. One awareness. This oneness of the experiencing self, true self, cannot be explained with the early Buddhist model of not self. The early Buddhist model includes the causal series type of self. But that causal series doesn't explain where the unity of this experiencing lies. The early Buddhist model actually says that in order to make the system work, it says experiences are not happening simultaneously.
Really?
Yeah, like the Abhidharma teachings say, we're not seeing and hearing simultaneously. They're happening very, very quickly in succession. So we... And in a dualistic consciousness, so consciousness sees a color, and then that experience ceases because it's impermanent. They're really into radical impermanence in early Buddhism. Then there's another moment, so quick we can't catch it, that's hearing a sound. Consciousness hears a sound, then that experience ceases. Then another moment, we're seeing again. So it's kind of alternating between seeing, hearing, feeling, thinking, hearing, you know, flashing of these impermanent flow. That's the early Buddhist model, which is, you know, they're trying to describe our life, right? And it seems like it doesn't account for our feeling of unification. It feels like a unified experience that sounds and sights and feelings and thoughts are arising simultaneously. It feels very strongly that that's the case. So I feel like the Buddha nature model is a little bit more intuitive. It's a little bit more accords with how we feel our experiencing to be. This sense of a unified experiencing, like there's one experiencing. That's this new Buddha nature model. They don't talk about one unified experiencing in early Buddhism. They're trying to get away from that because they feel like we can grasp that as an experiencer. A permanent experiencer. So, in this Buddha nature model then, if the multiplicity of experiences at one time, like this moment includes multiple experiences, this present experiencing includes this, multiplicity of experiences at this time, that multiplicity of experiences does not affect the oneness or unity of experiencing. In this case, then why should the multiplicity of experiences over different times affect the oneness or unity of experiencing? It's kind of what we've been talking about is this permanent, unchanging quality of awareness. If one awareness can be the experiencing of multiple experiences in this moment, then why could it not also be the case that it's one awareness, one experiencing over an entire lifetime or over beginninglessness, that there's one unchanging awareness that's experiencing a multiplicity of experiences over time, over so-called time? This might be a little hard to follow, but this is kind of reflecting a little bit, using some sort of logic and questioning and reasoning. Could it not be that there is actually one unchanging awareness throughout space and time? Yes?
When you're speaking at the moment, of what we conventionally call the individual causal self in this model, or at the moment, are you speaking of the entirety?
No, I'm talking about the entirety, the experiencing is another name for the true self, that there's one experiencing, and it can't even be divided into different beings. So we have to do some other reasoning, but we talked about that a little bit in the past. We can't find a division or a boundary between my awareness and your awareness. We could imagine one, a division, but that division is then an experience. It's an imagined experience between our two awarenesses. So we can't actually find a boundary or edge of awareness, and that means it's the entirety. So there's a lot of things we can explore in our own experience here. Yes, Rick.
So how with our limited dualistic consciousness can we conceive of an all-encompassing awareness that is outside of space and time?
Yeah, well, in a way, like in our discussion now, we're kind of conceiving it in words and concepts, right? Talking about it. But to actually be that, that's why these meditations like step by step, staying with our direct experience. Is awareness present? And as I mentioned the other day, I think, we confirm, yes, awareness is present. We can all do that right now. But actually what we usually find there is not this boundless awareness. We usually find dualistic consciousness. We're calling it awareness temporarily. But then we can start to explore, if it were truly all-pervading awareness, it would have to not have any boundaries or edges or coming and going. Those are the main things. We have to then explore within our own awareness, as our own awareness, do I, this awareness, have any edges, and do I seem to come and go, and arise and cease in time? And if we can, maybe we can't exactly confirm that I have no boundaries and I have no coming and going, but what we can confirm is that I can't find any boundaries. I really cannot, no matter where I look, I can't find any, and I can't find any coming and going. So it's more like, if I can't find any edges and I can't find any coming and going, as the awareness I'm talking about, as qualities of myself as the awareness, not, of course we can find boundaries and coming and going in the realm of experiences, but the awareness itself, if we can't find those, then sort of like innocent until proven guilty. Let's not assume that there are edges or boundaries if we've never found them, and let's not assume that something, that the awareness is changing and arising and ceasing if we can't find any change in it. So then we're starting to almost like deduce, or through a very careful, intimate, personal investigation, meditative investigation, we can start to open to this possibility, and it starts to make more and more sense, and it starts to become less like a metaphysical theory. Like, how could we say that this awareness pervades all space and time? Well, it's more like we just can't see, we can't find its limitations. Something like that. And I think that's what a lot of the Buddhist tradition is about, is trying to come to these, we can't find the kind of limitations. So then let's not say we can't find the unlimitedness either. But let's assume if we can't find the limitations, let's not assume that there are limitations. And then we're starting to, without getting a hold of unlimited, we can start to open to it more and more. And then, of course, we have the Buddha's teachings kind of saying this in words and kind of helping us be like, yeah, actually, this is what I'm talking about.
Still resident in the dependent arising. For instance, when I was walking to a concert at UC, and all of a sudden I wasn't hearing with my ears. It's not that I wasn't hearing, it's like I had this, I was hearing with everything, my total body experience. And also, poets and songwriters talk about their song or their poem coming through just as a piece, the entire piece. It seems like awareness is really like percolating everywhere at the same time and somehow bringing it all together and delivering it.
Yeah, it could be that that visually so-called eternal and all-pervading, then every possible experience throughout space and time could be accessible within there. And now this starts to sound a little metaphysical, so I don't really want to go there too far. But maybe so, right? It kind of makes sense. The more we can open to the eternal, all-pervading nature of Buddha, awareness, then everything throughout space and time must be included. Yeah.
Still in the causal series.
Well, it comes to us through the causal series, that the inspiration to the songwriter, and they suddenly find the whole song in their consciousness. You could say, wow, how did that happen? It happened in the causal series, but remember, the causal series is just a manifestation of the one true self. And all causal series are arising and ceasing within the one true self. Like all the reflections on the mirror, boundless mirror, all rising and ceasing on the one unchanging mirror. So, many possibilities in this realm. But before since we're time is passing and we haven't gotten to the sutra yet, I just want to mention one last thing and then continue on the sutra, and then hold your questions and let's see where we can go. Just as a practice thing, because I think Rick's bringing up, what about practicing with this? Here's just a very brief kind of three steps of how we might practice relating to the self here, right? These three types of self we've been talking about, right? So first, this is a very brief overview, but just sketching it out here. First, we can establish that all experiences of body and mind are not truly myself, my true self, because they're impermanent and conditioned. They're not worth grasping as I and mine. That's all Buddhist traditions, early Buddhism includes this. That's the first. Establish all experiences are not my true self. Second, establish that experiencing itself is boundless, timeless, and unconditioned. We establish that through careful exploration of our own awareness. Thereby we let awareness release its grasping onto the experiences of body and mind and sink into itself, recognizing its all-pervasive, ever-present nature as the true self. See how those are two different kind of steps? The first is establishing that all experiences of body and mind are not truly myself because they're impermanent and unconditioned. Second, establish that experiencing itself is boundless, timeless, unconditioned. And then we let awareness release its grasping onto experiences and sink back into itself.
How do we know that awareness is grasping onto experiences?
Well, that's just the
nature of causal series.
Yeah, that's the causal. Well, when we say awareness, again, I'm trying to distinguish the words consciousness and awareness here. We could say, when awareness is grasping experiences, we call that vijnana, we call that consciousness, dualistic consciousness. So let that illusion of dualistic consciousness, let go of the duality, grasping onto objects, and sink back into its all-pervading nature, where now the experiences are arising within it, so they can't be grasped because they're part of it. And this establishing that experiencing itself is boundless and timeless and unconditioned. We could say that's in the Zen tradition, like if we kind of like, the aha moment of that is kind of like, maybe Rinzai Zen would talk about like Kensho, like seeing, which means seeing Buddha nature, is like recognizing the boundless, unlimited quality of awareness, which is different than just disengaging from the experiences, establishing that the first step of establishing experiences are not my true self. That's the kind of early Buddhist model, and this Mahayana model is the second one about the all-pervading experiencing. And then third, establish that all experiences of body and mind and the world now appear within awareness, as awareness, not something in addition to awareness. Like there's no sound of raindrops in addition to the experiencing of the sound.
Would you say that again?
There's no sound of the raindrops in addition to
or apart from
the experiencing of the sound. In other words, there's just the experiencing, and the experiencing is expressing itself, manifesting itself as the sound of raindrops.
What's that one?
One hand clapping.
There's no one in the forest. Does the tree fall out? I still have my rational mind tries to make sense of that.
Yeah, we're doing all this with our rational mind, but these are little hints that we can try out more and more with our non-rational mind. So this third step is the collapsing of the apparent distinction between awareness, or our true self, and the experiences of body, mind, and world.
Say that again, please.
This is the collapsing of the apparent distinction between true self and the conventional self, of the appearances of body, mind, and world of colors and sounds and so on. This is the realization of non-duality. The second one wasn't really non-duality. The second one is just awareness is unchanging and all-pervading. This is now we're re-engaging the experiences of the world in relation to myself and seeing there's not a separation. I think it's nice to break it into these three steps like this to see what we're talking about. And that's when people like Changsha can say the entire universe in the 10 directions is the radiant light of the self. It's like non-duality. The first step is like realizing what's not myself. The second step is realizing what is myself. And the third is realizing that everything is myself. Okay. The Mahayana, Mahaparinirvana Sutra. I realize we're going through this fast, but that's why we're recording the talks, if you want to go back.
And maybe after this class is over, we'll send out a little instruction where we can find those recordings on the website?
Sure.
Great, thanks.
We're up to chapter 26, top of page 4 on this handout, on the action of a baby. And this is not one of the, like, you know, main sections of the sutra, but I just wanted to put it in here because it's the source of this jewel mirror samadhi, as it says, Dungshan's jewel mirror samadhi. That classic Zen poem that's so important in Soto Zen, they chant it like every day in Japan, says, you are not it. In truth, it is you. It's like a babe in the world in five aspects complete. It does not go or come, nor rise, nor stand. Baba wawa. Is there anything said or not?
Right.
So it's all this weird esoteric sounding thing, right? It's right from this Nirvana Sutra. This chapter is called Baby Action, Baby Conduct. And the Buddha says, why do we speak of a baby's action? A baby cannot stand up, stay, come, go, or speak. So our chant, we say, does not go or come, nor rise, nor stand. Baba Wawa, I think, does not speak, is the fifth. I think it's to make the meter rhyme, but this is five aspects of a baby that are listed here. It was slightly differently, but... So then the Buddha says, this is the state of a baby. It's the same with the Tathagata, the Buddha, who's like a baby. And one way, I think, to do this is, like, imagine that we're a newborn baby. It's completely projection because we don't know, right? But we can imagine, creatively imagine, that if we're a newborn baby, we have no reference to thought or memory, and therefore we have no thought or memory, we have no knowledge of having a body or being a body. That comes later for a baby, I would imagine. We are like a field of experiencing color and sound. It's total chaos. There's even some Zen koan about this total chaos of a newborn baby. I think, right? The six senses are just like a river. We're just a field of sensitivity, of knowing or experiencing. A field of knowing, experiencing. Or the knowing and experiencing of this field of experience is in five aspects complete. In other words, there's no going or coming or rising or standing or speaking. And there's a lot of experience happening, but it's like we're not yet contracted into, like, I am a body and a mind and five skandhas. So it's the same with the Tathagata. When we say unable to stand up, the Buddha says, the Tathagata does not raise up any aspect of anything. So he's kind of saying, it's literally a baby can't stand up, but that means, the Buddha says, as a kind of metaphor for the Buddha doesn't raise up any aspect of anything, doesn't raise up any part of reality, because everything is equally like space. You can't raise up part of space. Or remember, I spoke about exist means to stand out from. You can't have some part of this unity stand out from the unity. We say unable to stay. The Tathagata does not adhere to anything. We say unable to come. In the bodily action of the Tathagata, there's no moving. We say unable to go. The Tathagata has already entered great nirvana, so there's nowhere to go to. We say unable to speak. He speaks but does not speak. The Tathagata enacts expedient means and speaks, and through this he helps people understand. So as it also says in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, the meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Also, a baby speaks a big syllable. The same is the case with the Tathagata. He speaks a big word. This is vaba. Vaba. Va corresponds to the created, and ba to the non-created. This is the baby. Va is non-eternal, and ba is eternal. Beings hear this and understand it as eternal. This is the action of the baby. So in a way, I feel like it's talking about this, the created and the non-created, right? The conventional self and the true self. The non-eternal and the eternal. The conventional self and the true self. And the integration of those. The conventional self appearing as a reflection within the boundless mirror of the true self. So, and then Dungshan says, ba ba va va. So you could say it's combining non-created and eternal, and creating the eternal and the non-eternal. The created and the non-eternal and the non-created and the eternal. Yeah. So it's so he might be kind of playing with it a little bit. He's not quoting the sutra exactly, but it's coming from this section. So just a little reference to that. We don't need to dwell on it. So chapter 29. If Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, and Bodhisattvas do not see Buddha nature, we say nirvana. That's like early Buddhism. The early Buddhist model is these Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, and also even Bodhisattvas. They don't see Buddha nature, but they have some realization. They realize the cessation of greed, hate, and delusion, and the cessation of suffering before the Buddha nature teachings. That's what Pratyeka Buddhas and Bodhisattvas do. So we call that nirvana. But the Buddha here says it's not great nirvana. It's not maha pari nirvana. If they clearly see Buddha nature, this is great nirvana. Maha pari nirvana. So that's, I think, this sutra is making a distinction between the early Buddhist nirvana, which is freedom from greed, hate, and delusion and suffering. But it's not maha pari nirvana, which is this all-pervading reality that goes further than just cessation of suffering. The Tathagata pervades all places, just like space. So here's being clearly making this analogy to space. The nature of space cannot be seen. Similarly, the Tathagata cannot really be seen, and yet he causes all to see him through his sovereignty. And this might be this Aishvarya, we're talking about like the Ishvara, the ever-abiding independence in a way. The power of the Buddha, you could say, causes all to see him as a person manifesting as a nirmanakaya, even though his dharmakaya cannot really be seen. Such sovereignty is termed great self, or maha atman. They called, in India, they called Gandhi Mahatma, Mahatma Gandhi, right? Literally means great self. That great self is termed great nirvana. So the maha atman is also maha pari nirvana, like space that includes all things. So let's skip the rest of that paragraph and go down to chapter 32. Here the heading is, self is not the five aggregates or in them. And this piece is like straight out of the early teachings. It's kind of going back now to talk about what the self is not. Right? So a person might come to think that the self is the body or form or matter. This is rupa, rupa, skanda. That the self exists in the body, that there is a body in the self, or that the body belongs to the self. So these are four kind of relationships of the skandhas and the self. And this is something that like Chandrakirti in the and later Indian tradition really got into, of kind of a way to see that the five skandhas are not the self, but also anything in relationship to the five skandhas is not the true self. Because if it's in relationship to it, it means it's dependent and conditioned. It's one way to look at this. So the four types of relationships are that the self is the body. That's one. It's identical to the body. The self exists in the body. The self is something inside the body. That the body is in the self is the third. That there's some self kind of around the body that, in relation to the body, that kind of holds the body. And that the body belongs to the self is the fourth. In other words, there's a self that has a body. When we say, like, I have a body, we feel like I'm some, you know, independent entity that has a body. So there's a So you can reflect on this, that there's four different ways we often think of the self in relation to the body, and they're not true. And then you can go through all the four other skandhas. So the sutra just says, just goes straight to the last one, consciousness, vijnana. One might say that, or view the self as consciousness, dualistic consciousness, think that the self exists in dualistic consciousness, that dualistic consciousness exists in the self, or that dualistic consciousness belongs to the self. So if you take those four relationships of this, of each skanda with the self, and then times five skandhas, is 20 false views of self. And this is in other places in the Buddhist teaching too. And like Chandrakirti says that these 20 false views of self are the 20 mountain peaks on the mountain range of the separate self. And when you realize that no conditioned phenomena, no relationship to the five skandhas is a self, anything in relation to the five skandhas or the five skandhas themselves in any combination, if you realize all conditioned phenomena are not self, all 20 mountain peaks on this range are instantly destroyed. The whole range is destroyed. That's from his commentary on the Middle Way. So a lot could be said there about that, but that's a kind of overview. The Buddha here says, any such person who views things in these kind of 20 false ways belongs to Mara, which is like complete delusion, the evil one. Any person who sees things thus is not my disciple. To think that the self is somehow in the body, or the body's in the self, or all these things. So that's, you could spend a long time reflecting on these 20 relationships. There's no self in relation to any conditioned phenomena, is it? Or that is any conditioned phenomena, is the bottom line. And the Buddha says, there's no place where Buddha nature abides. Only through the best expedient means, upaya, is it able to appear like the sound of a lute which cannot be found in any part of the lute. And that's a nice story that's told over a page or two in the sutra of this, somebody hearing the lute. This is maybe a little bit like Corrine's point about being at the concert. Like, he heard this beautiful music of the lute, and the person was like, where's that sound? And like, and somebody comes and says, it's coming from this lute. And the person's like, well, I want to find that sound. And they start, is it in the body of the lute, the neck of the lute, the strings of the lute, the pegs? And he starts destroying the lute, looking for the sound in the pieces. And the person says, you're not going to find the sound in any of the pieces. Right? It's like, when the sound is unlocated, it doesn't reside in any conditioned piece, which is kind of like, it's not, the Buddha nature is not in any one of the five skandhas. So, chapter 33. To utter the lion's roar means to make it known that all sentient beings have Buddha nature, and the Tathagata is eternal and unchanging. I put that sentence in, even though we've been hearing this a lot, because that's the sentence that Dogen opens his Buddha Nature fascicle with, quoting that sentence from the Nirvana Sutra. It says, to utter the lion's roar, and Dogen, I think, just says, Buddha Nature is the lion's roar. And but Dogen quotes, all sentient beings have Buddha nature, and the Tathagata is eternal and unchanging. And then, as we talked about earlier, Dogen reads this, all beings have Buddha nature, as all beings are Buddha nature.
Which is quite a major distinction, actually.
Yeah, it really makes it more non-dual. Right. But I think we could say if we say all beings have Buddha nature, remember, it's not some located thing. It's not something in the body. It's, we could say, they have Buddha nature as their true self. All beings have Buddha nature as their reality. That's, I think, to say it like, to understand have in that way, it makes it kind of non-dual. So let's skip the rest of that section. You can read on your own. There are some interesting things about if one sees emptiness but does not see non-emptiness, we do not speak of it as the middle way. If one sees not self but does not see the self, we don't call this the middle way. The middle way is Buddha nature. So that's another reference to... It includes all conditioned things are not self, but it is also the true self. That's the middle way. So chapter 34, the Buddha nature, this is an interesting one, I think. Buddha nature of sentient beings has two causes. We've been saying it's unconditioned. Yeah, I know, right? I would say it's truly unconditioned. The sutra contradicts itself all the time, actually, in the sutra. But I think it's truly, we could say, unconditioned, but maybe conventionally speaking, has two causes. One is the true cause and the other the condition. The true cause is all sentient beings. The condition is the six perfections, the paramitas of giving, ethical conduct, patience, diligence, concentration, wisdom. So in that way you can see that it's not really a cause. It's just saying sentient beings are not just sound-detecting machines, but sentient beings that have a what-it-is likeness. These are the ones that have Buddha nature. That awareness definitely has something to do with sentient beings. They're in a way, the cause of Buddha nature. It's a funny way of talking. And then the condition that maybe you could say brings it out, manifests the Buddha nature, expresses the Buddha nature, is the six paramitas, practiced by a sentient being.
So they're kind of like the instrument of expression of awareness.
I think that's good, yeah. Instrument of expression of awareness, yeah. Then skipping down to the, down that paragraph some, how do we speak about the future is? For example, a person goes to a potter and asks, "Do you have a pot?" The answer comes back, "We have a pot," and yet there actually is no pot. As the potter has the mud, he says that he has the pot. It's the clay, but he doesn't really yet have the pot. Yet know that the person's not telling a lie. There is a pot in the clay, Buddha's saying, and he's saying there is butter in milk, right? It hasn't yet become butter. It's the same with the Buddha nature of sentient beings. If one wishes to see Buddha nature, one must contemplate time, form, and color, which is, I think, quoted in Dogen's Buddha Nature essay, too. For this reason, I say all sentient beings have Buddha nature. All beings definitely will attain unsurpassed perfect awakening. Because of this, I say in this sutra that all beings, down to those who have committed the five deadly sins, those who performed the four grave offenses that broken these parajika precepts, those who are completely depraved, the achantika that are sometimes said to have no Buddha nature, all these have Buddha nature. So Buddha said, chapter 36, one finds the Buddha nature of sentient beings in the different bodies of beings of the five realms, or the six realms of sentient beings. But the Buddha nature is always one, and there is no change. So I brought these out because it really says specifically there's one Buddha nature that's present in all types of sentient beings. Skipping down to chapter 39 here. You may say that the Buddha nature lives in sentient beings. Oh, good man, you should know that what is eternal has no place to dwell. If there's a dwelling place, this tells us that what is there is impermanent. Each of the blind people speak about the elephant after touching one of the parts. You maybe have heard this metaphor. like the parts are like the five aggregates. And yet, these, and what he says does not accord with the truth. Yet it's not that he does not speak about the elephant. It's the same with the person who speaks about Buddha nature. It's not any one of these things, yet it's not other than these five aggregates. It's not other than everything. Oh, good man, that's why I say that Buddha nature is not form, yet it's not separate from form. It's not the true self, nor is it other than the true self. So it's always these two sides. You could say it's the conventional and the ultimate. Many heretics say that there is a true self, but in truth there is no true self. The self of beings is the five aggregates, which is such so far out, because the early teachings are all about the self is not the five aggregates. So I think this is like this from this non-dual perspective, after we've come to understand that the self is all-pervading and includes everything, then you could say the five aggregates are, I would say it as manifestations or expressions of the true self.
So this is emptiness is form?
Yes, exactly. Emptiness is form. So this is a radical statement from the point of view of early Buddhism. For example, other than the aggregates, there's no self. For example, the stem, leaves, and calyx combine, and we get the bloom of a lotus. Other than this, there cannot be any flower. It's the same with the self of beings. So it's like they're kind of implying that dependent arising is Buddha nature. But then we have this other side of dependent arising is just the expression of the unarising Buddha nature. So I think the sutra is really getting into playing with all this stuff. So it's about time to stop. But just a couple more final words from chapter 40, I think, is really makes this nice point that Buddha nature of sentient beings is not inside or outside. It's like space, which is neither inside nor outside. If there were in and out in space, we could not say that space is one and eternal, nor could we say that it exists everywhere. Although space exists neither inside nor outside, all beings have it. And I'll just finish with this one piece, sentence in the middle of chapter 41. The Buddha nature of the stream enterer and the once returner who have abandoned defilements to some extent is like milk. So this is saying it's changing forms. These small vehicle practitioners who have somewhat enlightened, their Buddha nature is like milk. The Buddha nature of the non-returner, one further step, is like curds. That Buddha nature of the arhat is like butter. Buddha nature of the pratyeka Buddhas up to bodhisattvas of the 10 stages is like clarified butter. And the Buddha nature of the Buddha is like the pure essence of melted butter. So
it's ghee in there.
Ghee is, I think clarified butter is ghee. Yeah. So it's these more and more refined expressions or manifestations of the same substance. Which is interesting because it's kind of implying then that Buddha nature is changing or evolving, and we're talking about it's something that's eternal and unchanging. So this is, you could say, a kind of contradiction, but we could understand it as that the essence of milk is the same, the nature of milk, but as these degrees of awakening are happening, it gets more and more refined.
It changes the experience of the causal series.
That's a nice way to put it. The experience of milk is now called butter. Yeah. So there's kind of it's sort of a progressive, evolving Buddha nature description, even though other descriptions say that Buddha nature doesn't evolve or change.
I think it's almost as though there's an implied phrase between the and Buddha nature. The experience of Buddha nature, of the stream enterer and of this one and that one.
Yes.
Not the Buddha nature itself.
That's right. It's the experience of. So later in chapter 41, the Buddha says, if one says that all beings definitely have Buddha nature, this is grasping. If one says that they do not have it, this is false. The wise ones say, the Buddha nature of beings is neither existent nor non-existent. So then later in chapter 42, the Buddha says almost the same thing. He says, if someone says that all sentient beings definitely have or definitely do not have Buddha nature, such a person slanders the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So this kind of teaching that's coming later in the sutra about Buddha nature neither existing nor non-existing is really kind of sets the stage for the Zen ancestors who were very diligent about not falling into either extreme of existence or non-existence. So, for example, Chinese Zen ancestor Zhaozhou, when asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? He said, yes. And then that monk asked, well, if it has Buddha nature, why is it in this skin bag? And Zhaozhou said, because it knows yet deliberately transgresses, or it knowingly and willingly transgresses Buddha nature, knowingly and willingly manifests itself as a dog. And then later, a monk asked Zhaozhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Zhaozhou famously said, no, or mu in Japanese. And the monk said, well, all sentient beings have Buddha nature, according to the Nirvana Sutra. Why does the dog not have any? And Zhaozhou said, because he still has karmic dualistic consciousness. So we don't want to fall into Buddha nature exists or doesn't exist, that all beings have Buddha nature or don't have Buddha nature. If we make any of these definitive statements, they're a little bit too extreme. They're a little bit too one-sided for the Zen ancestors. And non-Buddha nature, the Buddha says, refers to walls, pebbles, stones, and non-sentient things. So this, in like the Jijiyu Zamai, we chant about walls, tiles, pebbles, I think it's coming from this Nirvana Sutra, where the sutra says, these walls, tiles, and pebbles don't have Buddha nature. We're talking about sentient beings. But the Zen tradition didn't like that. They thought I was a little dualistic. Yeah. So national teacher Hui Zhang talked about the teaching of the non-sentient, and he quoted the sutra here and said, rocks, tiles, and pebbles are actually Buddha nature. So that's a kind of like a Zen, kind of a Zen refutation of the sutra to make it Buddha nature more expansive. Thank you for your patience, and of course there's much more we could talk about, but this is a brief overview of the Parinirvana Sutra, teaching of true self and Buddha nature, and I hope it's planted good seeds to contemplate this for many lifetimes of causal series. We dedicate the merit of our discussions and wholehearted practice of Buddha nature to the complete perfect awakening of all beings. May they fully appreciate and enjoy their true self. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.